What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel. What is up, everybody, and welcome to the final author panel here on day three of TBRCon 2024. I hope you've all been enjoying the convention so far, and thank you to everyone tuning into this live stream. I'm Adrian M. Gibson, your moderator for this evening. I'm the co-host of the SFF Addicts podcast and author of Mushroom Blues, my upcoming fungal punk genre blending murder mystery debut, which releases on March 19th. And on the topic of blending genres, we're here to answer the monumental question: is science fantasy still sci-fi? To help me crack this conundrum is a brilliant panel of guest authors, and I'll go through the panelists one by one, and each of you can just give a quick introduction. So I'll start. We'll just go clockwise with Seanan.
Hello, I am Seanan McGuire, and this is Elsinore, who I'm probably going to be yelling at a lot because she is shoving as many claws into my body as she can. I write stuff pretty much incessantly. Are you going to leave? You're going to leave. Yay. I have two hands again.
Your blood is insufficient now. She doesn't want
my blood is insufficient. She has been removing it systematically for the last 10 minutes and is done with me. I basically have a college degree in science fantasy in that I went to the University of California, Berkeley, go Bears, for a dual major in folklore and herpetology, which is very much the science fantasy degree. And every advisor I had told me I was going to be working at a McDonald's by now.
Suck it to all of those advisors. That's amazing, though. I love that you have a major, a double major in that, and perfect
snakes
that you're on this
fairy
panel.
Tales.
We got this. All right, Khan Wong.
Hi, everyone. I'm Khan, and I am a boring old English major.
Me too.
I'm the author of The Circus Infinite, out from Angry Robot Books. And my next book coming out from Angry Robot is due out in a year from now. It's another science fantasy, and I'll just leave it at that. Right.
Thank you, buddy. Alex?
Hey, guys. I'm Alexander Darwin. I'm author of The Combat Codes, which debuted in June from Orbit Books. And my second book in the series, Grievous Blood, is out since December now. So good to see everyone.
And book three, Blacklight Born. When is that
sometime
out?
Sometime in 2024 or later. I think I don't know. They figure it out. I don't have control. After leaving self-publishing, I have no control. So
yeah, just take it away. All right, Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom, or T.A. Bruno, but that's just what the strangers call me. I wrote Down Below Beyond and a couple other sci-fi fantasies called The Song of Kamaria. And I'm also sporting my finest Adrian M. Gibson t-shirt.
Thanks, man. Show them the back, though.
Oh, yeah, I could do it. I was about to say, I could do that, but then I have to, totally strip down. But that's what we're all here for, right?
That's what we're all here for.
Yeah, right?
Forget science fantasy.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate you wearing that.
I thought it was awesome. So I'm like, oh, what perfect time to wear it until now.
Nice.
In my day job, I actually work for DreamWorks Animation, and I love sci-fi fantasy and write it. I'm on my fifth book that I'm outlining right now, and that's where I am.
Right on. And finishing off with Aparna.
Hi, everyone. My name is Aparna. I am the author of The Phoenix King, which is a sci-fi fantasy. It's my debut novel, which came out in August with Orbit. Seanan, I'm sorry, we are enemies. I went to Stanford, so go trees. The UC Berkeley is our dire enemies. But No, there's all love. It's as long as we're nerds, English nerds, there's all love.
Yeah. We don't have competition here. Unless it's like, I mean, we're going to get into some pretty murky waters with science fantasy and sci-fi and the fantasy and all that shit. We're going to figure it out. But I want to start off this discussion with a basic question. What does science fantasy mean to all of you? And I'll throw it to Tom first.
Oh, man.
You're wearing my shirt, man. You made me happy, yeah. So I'm just going
to
throw
this is what I get for sucking up to the host.
sci-fi. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. I did it on purpose. And I didn't tell you until now because I'm like, oh, I'm surprised. sci-fi fantasy to me. Just the quick background for when I first got into sci-fi, I always just thought it was as simple as sci-fi has lasers, pew, pew. And fantasy has magic, you know, Expelliarmus or whatever they say in Harry Potter. But I've come to realize that sci-fi is a very, very deep genre with a bunch of, you know, like kind of layers to it. And I kind of want to consider it a gradient, you know, like there's science and then there's fantasy, and books kind of fall within the gradient. They either lean one way or another. So sci-fi fantasy to me is like something that's, you know, a little bit like Star Wars or something, where you have spaceships, you have orbit, you have planets and different biomes. Maybe you're leaning into biology a little bit, but you still have things that you can't quite explain, or you don't take the time to explain, something like that, like, you know, time travel or, you know, it's just various things like that. You kind of get what I mean. But yeah, that's kind of what it means to me. So,
cool. And Con?
There it is.
To me, science fantasy is narrative and artistic freedom and casting off the shackles of genre limitations. Like, that's my glib answer.
I'm changing my answer.
It's all about liberation.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's pretty straightforward, and it is what it says on the tin. It's stories that combine scientific or technological elements with something supernatural or magical in a nutshell. Nice.
Cool. And Aparna, what about you?
For me, I think just carrying off of everyone's answers, it's like this beautiful blend of both what I always think more so the future and the past. And it's actually something we talked about when I was on your podcast, Adrian, of how I feel like in the modern world, even now, we have quote unquote fantastical elements, which religion, astronomy, we have these remnants of the past, like old religious texts that allow us to discover and talk about the intangible, right? And that's kind of where I see fantasy. Fantasy is quote unquote magic. Fantasy is quote unquote belief, religion. It's the things that make you question the world and admire its beauty, while sci-fi kind of explains it, you know? So for me, science fantasy is like a blend of both the magic and the explanation, but it lives in harmony.
I like that. We're all about harmony here.
Yeah.
Not competition, harmony.
No competition. Sorry.
And Shannon, what about you?
So the interesting thing about science fiction versus fantasy is that science fiction can age out. You know, Con Wong mentioned technology being a core component of science fiction. Well, if you look at something like the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is very much fantasy today, a lot of the arms and armament that they were using would have been cutting edge technology. Yeah. Being able to have a sword made of alloyed metal, my God, you're ready to fight the gods themselves. So something can be science fiction today and then slowly fall out the bottom of the genre. A lot of H.G. Wells was hard science fiction when it was written, and is science fantasy at best now, and will just be purely fantasy in another 50, 60 years. John Wyndham suffered the same fate, if suffer is really an accurate term there, because it's not, there's no shame in going from science fiction to fantasy. They're both vital. But much as I like to say that fairy tales are proof that urban fantasy is really the oldest subgenre of science fiction fantasy, all early science fiction is proof that science fantasy comes for us all.
I like it. The inevitability. Awesome. Alex, you want to wrap up these thoughts?
Yeah, no, I like what everyone said. I like what Khan said. From my personal perspective, coming at science fantasy, I do like the liberation of it. And I think I personally came at it from an angle of just not really knowing what genre I was writing in and taking from the sources that I was inspired by. And then from like a reader perspective, I think what Tom said about having a gradient is really important, because people tend to, you know, look at it in a very black and white perspective. I think there are landmarks along the gradient that tend to sway readers towards one or the other. Like, for example, a very heavy landmark would be, does it take place? Is there a planet Earth? And for me, that's like, for me personally, if I'm writing something that has a planet Earth, a Star Trek versus a Star Wars that has no planet Earth, from what I know,
has one. Come on, man.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Star Trek has a planet Earth, and Star Wars does not.
Okay, yeah.
And so that, for just being a human that lives on planet Earth, like most of us, I think that that's kind of like a defining landmark. But there are a lot of other landmarks that may sway people in one way or another, like as Sean had said, the technology of the time, where that's evolved, magic, not magic, that sort of thing.
Right. Okay. This is an interesting jumping off point, and it kind of leads right into my next question in terms of, for each of you, I want to pick your brains about what you feel are some distinctive elements of science fantasy, essentially like what makes a story science fantasy in your mind, whether it comes to like world building. Alex, you just mentioned something as evident as like, does Earth exist within the context of this story? So what are some things that come to mind when you're reading a story and you feel like this is science fantasy? These are some quintessential elements. Aparna?
I just knew you were going to pick on me first.
You're not wearing a shirt, but you're not wearing
my shirt. Yeah, I know. Right? I guess I should have been indoctrinated into the Adrian cult beforehand.
The merch cult.
Yeah, right? No, I have to get at Worldcon. No, for me, for science fantasy, for me, the hallmarks are more so having this element of the inexplicable. So, and I always, this is kind of going back to my first question of fantasy, you know, I think of fantasy as like a lot of world building, of myths, religion, kind of explaining the lore of the world. So for example, I'll bring up like in The Phoenix King, a lot of the fantastical elements revolves around some of the religious systems of, you know, fire channeling, the worship of fire, that draws a lot from Hindu mythology. But then the sci-fi elements come from this aspect of how we use instruments of destruction to uphold nationhood, uphold sovereignty, and also how we use that to invade. So for me, it's this blend of like using technology as a means to colonize, to destroy, it can also be used, you know, to further development. But it also needs to have this sense of like deep world building that comes from the lore, the religion that the world is built upon.
Yeah, I was going to say, like reading your book, there is a duality to the technology. It's not necessarily like these are tools of destruction, but it's like people can use them on a basic like day-to-day level as a way to improve their lives, as a way of getting around via transport and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I think it was cool that you highlighted the spectrum of what technology can bring to the table. Not necessarily that it's just a tool for the government or the nation to uphold its sovereignty and uphold its military might or whatever, but then you kind of bring it down to the basic levels of individual people interacting within local communities and stuff like that.
Yeah, I also think like what's interesting is that I'm glad you brought up the duality, because it also goes to the idea of like what's not seen as like sci-fi. So the idea of like fire, right, fire channeling, fire wielding, it's seen as both as a way that gives sustenance. It's what an entire religion and country was built upon, but it's also a means of destruction. It's how this whole religious system of a prophet used to destroy, you know, invading nations. So it has that duality of, and it doesn't need to be technology. It can also be, you know, your religion as well.
Yeah, cool. Colin, what about you in terms of some distinctive elements of science fantasy?
Well, I think to distinguish science fantasy from science fiction, there needs to be an element of the impossible. So that could be magic, that could be psychic abilities of some kind, or superpowers, or magical creatures, or whatever. And to distinguish it from fantasy, there needs to be some grounding in reality, either in actual scientific concepts or in, I guess, what I would call mundane reality, but then that kind of makes it urban fantasy. No, so for science fantasy, there needs to be some kind of grounding in either some kind of scientific concept, but also I feel like a lot of what gets marketed as science fiction mostly is aesthetic, like more than, I mean, like, so for example, my book, The Circus Infinite, it's shelved as science fiction. I consider it space fantasy, and can talk about that later, but it's shelved as science fiction, but there's not even a little bit of actual real science in it. It's a futuristic spacefaring society, and there's aliens. And so therefore science fiction, but that's really a superficial gloss of like the feel and the look of it, you know, even though there's no science. Mm-hmm. So I guess my point is, I don't know what my point is. to distinguish it from science fiction, there needs to be some element of the impossible. And I think to distinguish it from fantasy, it has to be more than just surface level.
Mm-hmm. So, Alex, you want to build on that?
You know, that's really interesting from what Khan just said, as far as the marketing's perspective of it and where books are shelved. Because like the Combat Codes, you know, I see it again. I didn't even write it with a genre in mind. I just kind of wrote what I knew, and it both had technology and unexplainable elements that were not considered technology, aka magic of some extent. When Orbit acquired it, they shelved it, or I guess it's the publisher that is shelving something and, you know, sending it to the booksellers as sci-fi. But most like reviewers / booktubers / whatever, TikTok, Instagram, have classified it like in their lists as fantasy. So it's just very strange and somewhat confounding. And end of the day,
wasn't that something that happened when you entered into SPFBO, where it was, yes, like, there was a kerfuffle about like,
there was like a very heated argument about whether it was sci-fi or fantasy. And I was like, guys, I don't, whatever. I'm not like whatever, but it is what it is. But I guess what I think is very interesting is there's a business element to it, obviously, as far as whether a book is shelved as sci-fi or fantasy. Mm-hmm. And obviously a publisher or someone who's self-publishing is going to push it towards that, you know, specific genre or subgenre. So I find that interesting. And I think that does play on how readers interpret it. I mean, obviously, end of the day, once a reader has completed the book, they're going to have their own opinion on it. But I think they're heavily influenced by, you know, how some, like, just like, let's think of the really big fandoms, Star Wars and Star Trek. Obviously, there's a lot of benchmarks in each of those that might classify it as either sci-fi or fantasy. But I think also the way that they're interpreted and then passed down almost as lore becomes a big part of which direction they go.
Mm-hmm. And in your mind, are there some distinct things that kind of merge that together you know, because we can classify it on one side or the other. And I think it's interesting, like, Crystal finds your book at the fantasy section at the bookstore. So it's like,
we can talk more about it. And as Crystal just said, there are some bookstores, and I don't know how it works. Like, I guess maybe a publisher will push a bookseller towards, but at the end of the day, it must be the bookseller that's deciding how it's shelved. And I have seen it shelved as fantasy, and it may be different in the UK versus the US. And that's very interesting too. And again, for me, I think end of the day, it's a gradient. There's benchmarks that push it in one direction or another, but certain readers might see something that's urban fantasy as more on the fantasy side or more on the sci-fi side, depending on which way the author's pushing.
Yeah, right. Shannon, what about you in terms of this, like, these quintessential elements, things that you think of when reading a science fantasy story?
So it's interesting that Alexander spent so much time talking about how we don't make those decisions, because there are other factors in play. A person who is identified as or assumed to be male who writes a science fiction novel with fantasy elements is statistically more likely to show up in the science fiction section.
Right,
where
right.
Male or female assumed author writing that same book gets shelved in fantasy or even in young adult. And that's because the prejudices of the people doing the shelving 100% carry over into where they put our books. Those categories are not absolutes. They are an attempt to get your book into the hands of a reader who will actually like them. You know, booksellers are a little more invested in granular marketing than, say, the producers of the Mean Girls movie, who just did their absolute best to trick people into going to a musical. And it wasn't even a good musical. The Broadway show was fantastic. The version that they've put in theaters is terrible. But I have been on panels about hard science fiction in books, because when I am Mira Grant, who is an Orbit author, I am a hard science fiction author. I do 3 years of scientific research on every book. And I've had people congratulate the male author before me on his incredible made-up science, and then start arguing with me about a subtle point of virology that has been proven or disproven since the book came out. You know, it's like, well, I was right when I wrote that book. I'm not right now, later. There's a difference. I would say science fantasy, for it to be true science fantasy, your science fiction must in some way hinge upon the impossible. Anne McCaffrey's two Ride Pegasus books, which are science fiction. They depend on interstellar travel, genetic manipulation, a whole bunch of sci-fi tropes, but they also depend on psychic powers strong enough to slingshot a ship from Earth out past the edge of the Oort cloud. Doctor Who. We can't really argue that Doctor Who is not a fantasy show, especially after we've just gone to goblins and creatures of children's lore from beyond the edge of time, but you can't have Doctor Who without the TARDIS. It falls apart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Number of this is okay assumptions. I will give you that a lightsaber is a scientific thing. A time machine is a scientific thing. I can buy that as my one exception if you tell me that's how this world works. But you only get so many of those. We just had someone ask, do you feel with the push of romanticy, less sci-fi is being published right now? 100% no. There is so much science fiction out there because, again, not to become the sexism microphone on this panel, there are a lot of male-identifying readers who won't pick it up if it's a kissing book. They won't read The Princess Bride. Mm-hmm. They've heard it's a kissing book. And that is a terrible generalized statement, but it is unfortunately true. It does not apply to everyone. Nothing we say here can apply to everyone. But they have to keep publishing the science fiction or they lose that section of the readership.
Yeah, very true. Shannon, I want to throw this comment up there as well, because I just love it. This is the Mean Girls side of publishing, and it is very true, unfortunately.
It's a cautionary tale full of fear and love and pride based on actual events where people died.
All right. I love it. We got a sing song going up in here. This is a fantastic panel so far. Tom, I'm going to get your thoughts on this and then we'll shift into some other topics. But when it comes to everything everyone else has said, if you want to comment on it, but also some aspects of science fantasy that really stand out to you as elements that you feel are quintessential.
Yeah, I mean, everything everybody has said has been awesome, and I feel bad being the last one to follow up because it's like, what do I add to this? The only thing I could think to add to it is that, exactly what pretty much everybody has said, where, you know, the science element should feel possible, and it should feel like something that grounds the reader in some sort of a hard reality a little bit, but then you use the fantasy to kind of cut the corner of things you can't explain or don't want to explain or want to explore that can't happen. And maybe you're using this fantasy element to make a metaphor of something happening in real life that, you know, you can't use science to do. There's been lots of books I've read that, you know, I get shocked when I'm like, wait, that's like things that are going on right now. And it, not only is it a book written 40 years ago or something like that, but it's using like aliens to do it. And I'm like, that's awesome. You know, but of course, there's no way this alien could exist, but yet I'm working with it because it's grounded in a way that I get it. But still it has that fantastical element where, like, this alien can read minds, yet nothing on Earth can read minds, except, I don't know, reviewers. I like those guys. So that's all I really got on that. Everybody else had such great points that honestly, I just muck it up at this point.
No, dude, enough of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Tom, I'm going to start with you because allow each of you, Aparna, you've touched on your work a little bit. And there are many facets of what we've just discussed that we'll touch on throughout the conversation, but I wanted to give everyone watching and listening an opportunity to hear a bit about your stories that you would kind of fit into this science fantasy mold. So, Tom, if you could tell people why you personally decided to write science fantasy, and if you can describe a little bit about the stories and worlds and that you've written and how they kind of fit into that mold.
Oh, sure. It's a little bit like what Alex had said earlier, where when I started writing, it was really just the things I was aware of stories I liked, you know, growing up and stuff like that, where, you know, it had these fantastical elements to it, but it was still rooted in some kind of sci-fi world, things like, you know, Final Fantasy, Star Wars, stuff like, well, some of the Final Fantasy, sorry, they're not all quite like that anymore. When I was a kid, there's just like seven of them. Anyway,
Alex has a,
you know, stuff like that. yeah, exactly. Sorry, I can go off on a tangent on those. Those are great. But anyway, so with stories like, for instance, like Down Below Beyond, my newest one, I decided to go with an even more fantasy approach with this one by including a collection of worlds that are connected by something called the Voyalton Portal Network. It's these portals that were created by, you know, a civilization of aliens that knows how to do it, but nobody else really does. And they kind of just go to worlds, they, you know, assess them a little bit, and then they ask if they even want to be included. And if they say yes, then they turn on the portal, everybody's linked. And then there's this, you know, network of portals that links a place called Load Space together. And of course, somebody has exploited this and made it into a trade empire of some sort. But so, you know, we have worlds, we have planets, we have various aliens and stuff, but we're using something like Voyalton portals, which is something humans can't explain. And that's where our fantasy element kind of comes in. And then linking all these different, you know, civilizations and stuff like that, I got to have a lot of fun just creating new things, new ideas. How do certain things work? How would like a race of, you know, sea lions build a city and stuff like that? Or how do they get along with the people, you know, the kind of aliens that could walk on land? Well, they'd probably make a little device that allows them to walk around and stuff like that, which would be normal for them, you know, stuff like that, where, you know, we try to, you know, we've taken a weird thing, but now we've tried to make it, you know, gel with other things that are lesser weird, you know. And yeah, I do that with all my stuff. The Song of Kamaria as well. It's humans get kind of chased out of the soul system, end up on a planet of, you know, telepathic bird people. So, you know, we're fine right up until we see those bird people. And it's like, okay, well, now, like, well, okay, how do they work? And, you know, we take, like, well, if they're telepathic, what kind of society would that entail, and you know, I deep dive into all that kind of stuff and try to make it in a way that, you know, scientifically, if everybody could read minds, how would they kind of operate with each other? You know, so I'm taking fantasy and I'm kind of harnessing it a little bit, but not so much that it doesn't get to live on its own and, you know, do its own thing. And that's, and like I said in the beginning, when I started writing them, I thought this was just sci-fi and this is just kind of how it works. Then I was informed later on, as you know, just time went on, it's like, oh, this is actually has a lot of fantasy elements to it and stuff. And I'm like, you know, you're right. That's really cool. I never really thought of it. I just figured this is kind of how it works. And, you know, maybe that's kind of ignorant of me, but I just, I'm glad I was informed of that. Now I can lean into it harder.
Yeah.
And like Sean said, it's like science fantasy comes for us all. I love that. Because, and I mean, no matter, even if I figured out how bird people could telepathically figure us out, eventually I'm going to be wrong about that. So I mean, it's kind of nice to be able to like jump ahead and then just kind of be wrong ahead of time.
No, it's like science fantasy didn't come to you. You went to science fantasy.
There you go.
Yeah.
I roar shark.
Alex, do you want to elaborate a little bit on your experience? Because you mentioned how you kind of stumbled into it too. But what?
Yeah. I definitely do. Just to pick up on what Tom was saying that I really liked is, as far as the telepathic bird people, what I think I've just kind of come upon that I really like about science fantasy is that, you know, I think it's rooted, much of science fantasy is rooted in familiar, you know, fantasy is rooted in familiar through tropes and characters that you can identify with, and the worlds are familiar, it, you know, mirror images to our own. But as far as science fantasy, I think you can really start a reader in something that's extremely familiar, something that is actually either our actual world, you know, meaning Earth, or some environment that it is something people have actually experienced, and then take it to something that is unexplicable and fantastical. And you know, that I think all fiction does that to some extent. But I think science fantasy has the best of both worlds, which is really given the namesake of it, because you're able to take from that. The Combat Codes, my series, you know, takes on a question that is very pertinent to our world, which is, you know, how are our disputes between nations solved? And it has an answer, which is single combat between champions, and all the politics and the world building is manifest from that single question of how would a world be laid out if all disputes were solved through single combat. And as far as the fantastical elements, that's just kind of my own enjoyment writing, throwing things in like, well, you know, they would be fighting in these circles that would affect them. There would be certain circles that they fought in that the crowd's, you know, boos or cheers would, you know, literally sway a fighter like a magic spell, an incantation would, or maybe make them very angry, which would potentially, you know, be a negative to their ability to compete. So.
Yeah, I like it. And like the isn't it like the platforms themselves are like made out of different materials that can.
Yeah, no. So those are the circles that they fight in the platforms. Mm-hmm. So various. And again, I don't have a concrete science background, and I know if you dig yourself down that hole of trying to explain things too thoroughly, then readers will certainly you know, go down that road with you. And I did not want to go down that road with this book, although I am writing a science fiction and there's a lot of research involved. And that's a whole, as Sean had said, with the 3 years of virology research, I've just hit the tip of the iceberg there. And it's a lot of work.
Oh, definitely, dude. And Sean, what about you? Why did you decide that you wanted to write science fantasy? Was it like a conscious thing, or was it something that you kind of stumbled into as well?
Again, I'm a girl, so I keep getting filed as science fantasy, whether I meant to or not. I don't really have a choice in that. What I wanted to write was horror. I really wanted to write horror. And it turns out that even when I host a zombie apocalypse, I'm more interested in the scalpel than the shine. You know, I want to see the science. I want it to make sense. You know, T.A. Bruno, Tom, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm terrible at names, so I try to pronounce them correctly.
No worries. I probably should just pick Tom for now.
Yeah, Tom was mentioning figuring out how different things would work. We have a term for that in the furry community called Furgonomics. So if you assume, you know, your fantastic element is that mermaids are real, how do you build a chair for a mermaid? What does a couch look like if it's going to be used by both humans and people who have scales? And that is a really interesting rabbit hole to go down. You can get a long way with that. My only intentional science fantasy is the Encrypted series, which I have volume 13 comes out in March. Because I have no chill. And that assumes every mythological creature and folkloric creature from anywhere in the world is 100% real and actually exists. And I have to figure out how to explain it in a quasi-comprehensible scientific manner. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of fun, because some of the things that we dismiss as impossible are more possible than things that actually exist. There are cold-blooded mammals and hot-blooded snakes, and those are both real things that exist in the world right now. So I spend a lot of time on the Furgonomics of that, and I get pulled back by my editors. That's a lot of fun, and it's great when people call that science fantasy, because it is. When people call my Mira Grant work science fantasy, I turn a really attractive shade of purple, sputter a lot, and have to excuse myself.
Yeah, because it's just... I can imagine it's like writing with intention. Obviously there are times like with Tom and Alex where you kind of stumbled into it organically, but when you're purposefully writing something, and then it's obviously genres are at the end of the day kind of bullshit. Mm-hmm. And it is a marketing sort of categorization system. And the fact that you are writing these things with so much intention, and then to have them mislabeled and probably put on a different shelf and probably skewing readers' expectations of what they might find in that book as well.
I spent 4 years consulting with the CDC, infected myself with a tapeworm, and got vaccinated against diseases that no longer exist. I should not be labeled science fantasy. I should be labeled science obsessive.
To the point where you're just like experimenting on yourself
pretty much.
Yeah. And Con, what about you? What attracted you to this realm, and can you talk a little bit more about the Circus Infinite?
Sure. So like writing science fantasy was not so much an intentional choice as it was or is a kind of natural outgrowth of my tastes and interests. You know, I've explored many other creative modes as well. When I used to play music seriously, and I played the cello, but I played rock and folk music with the cello and classical music. Mm-hmm. I was very active in circus arts and the flow arts for a long time. And I kind of made my name. So my primary tool in that realm was the hula hoop. But I became known in that community for taking elements of object manipulation and contact juggling and incorporating it into the hula hoop and mixing the techniques. And then even as something as basic as like Miss Me with primary colors, you know, I'm all about the secondary and tertiary colors. Like, and I love fusion cuisines. Like, there's just something in my taste and kind of psychology, I guess, that just is drawn to hybridization and cross-pollination mm-hmm. and mixing of things, and mixing different elements to see what happened. And, you know, I've read all the like kind of standard fantasy books that people start out with, Lord of the Rings and Narnia and what have you. But the things that were the biggest influences or impacts on my imagination as a young person were superhero comics and Star Trek. And so when I started like crafting stories, it wasn't so much a conscious choice of like, I'm going to mix scientific elements and fantastical elements and see what, like, it was more just the nature of the stories that came to me just naturally were that because of just like how I am, I guess.
Yeah.
So with the Circus Infinite, I think I prefer the term space fantasy to describe the Circus Infinite because that more accurately says what it is. It is a fantasy story set in space. There's zero, like, science has nothing whatsoever to do with anything. I mean, it's set in a futuristic spacefaring civilization. The space travel between far reaches of the galaxy is made possible by a network of stable wormholes created by a sentient dark matter star. So, I mean, that's kind of quasi-scientific, but that's about as much actual, even nodding to real science as there is in the book. So for me, like, space fantasy is like really describes what the Circus Infinite is. The next book that I have coming out, I think, is more firmly science fantasy. It's also a little bit historic fiction. I can't help but like throw in different things. But one of the storylines, there's three parallel storylines that come together in my next book. One of them is set in a post-climate catastrophe Earth. So I did do a lot of research in climate science and looking at like models of like what the San Francisco Bay Area will look like in the early 2100s. But there's also people with psychic powers. So there's like actual science that's part of developing the setting. But then there's stuff that happens within that setting that are purely fantastical. So that's kind of the way I go about it. And for the next book after that, who even knows what I'll do?
Who knows where your hybridization is going to lead you next?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. And Aparna, we'll close it with you in terms of, so you started writing, well, you originally self-published it as The Boy with Fire, but then you had it published traditionally with Orbit as The Phoenix King. But when you're creating that world, did you go into it consciously wanting to mix the science with the fantastical, or how did that go?
I think for me, it was very similar to Khan in that I just wanted to write what my imagination naturally inclined towards. I have always wanted to see brown Indian characters in futuristic settings where they're not seen as the oppressed, as we see in other sci-fi shows sometimes, you know? And so I wanted to see my people, my culture in a quote unquote future where we belonged. And that's kind of where it was like my personal mission of like, this is why, you know, why I was so hard bent on creating some more so the futuristic elements, because it gave, It was a statement of like, we deserve to be seen in the future. We deserve to also be leaders. We deserve to also have positions of power. Even if currently we don't, we will in the future. So it was a way to kind of emulate that in whatever small ways that I could in the book. I want to go back to what Shannon said about how you don't really have control, especially as a woman, of like where you're placed on the shelf. I was tagged in one angry review where someone said, this book has too much sci-fi. I thought this was hardcore fantasy, one star. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I did not mean for that to happen. Also, why are you tagging me in this?
Yeah, that's just vindictive. It's like, come on, yeah. Just keep that shittiness to yourself.
Yeah. So to me, it's like, I've always believed that, you know, even in our present situation, we're quote unquote blended between the future and the past. You know, we have billionaires going to Mars right now, or attempting to go to Mars, going to the moon. And yet we can't stop ourselves from believing in the things that we can't explain, like gods, religion, what does it mean to be loved? What does it mean to be seen? What is identity? And sci-fi doesn't, to me, doesn't give you, or like scientific innovations doesn't give you a sufficient answer that I would be satisfied with. I go more so towards, quote unquote, the fantastical elements of our society, which is the magic, which is the love, which is the religion. And that's where I find comfort. So when I was writing The Phoenix King, it almost seemed natural to bring both of those elements to it, because, you know, even in a futuristic society, we will always have our own gods. We will always have a religious belief. We will always have one way, even like we may have figured everything out, but I think it's human hubris to believe we will explain everything. And that's why we have that fantasy. That's why we have something to explain the impossible. And so that's why The Phoenix King also has, you know, they might be futuristic, but they believe in this vengeful goddess who will, you know, come and save them all one day, because they can't explain where they came from.
Yeah. And Aparna, I want you to kind of kick us off on this next question, which is building on what you said, building on what Shannon said, and this kind of this sort of notion of what publishers or authors, the kind of confusion that arises from how to market these kinds of stories. And then from the reader perspective, the kind of expectations that they might have in mind that are, you know, they're manipulated by forces beyond the readers, whether it's like, you know, Alexander's publisher marketing it as science fiction, but then booksellers shelving it as fantasy. It's kind of this like very confusing game of like genre telephone. So from your perspective, Aparna, like what are some of the challenges that you faced in terms of marketing your stories and working with Orbit, and how Orbit has kind of approached that, and things that you've experienced? You've already talked about that one-star review, but other experiences that you've had when it comes to readers reacting to something based on what they thought was the truth about how your book is marketed and the genres and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, because I don't think there's ever going to be a satisfactory answer of like what the solution would be, other than like we destroy all genres. It's a free for all at the bookstore. Just go and see what you discover. You know, like, but I think people love order. They love to be like, you know, whether you like to be categorized or not, people like to have categories to understand where to go in the bookstore. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Orbit, so I remember having a very clear conversation with my past editor, and she was saying like how I think Alex, maybe you may were talking about this, like when they create the BISAC codes, which are the codes that they use, I think, in the Library of Congress to where to shelve your book. And that's like, is it fiction? Is it fantasy? Is it sci-fi? And they have those little subgenres. And that is just like a legal, I don't know if it's a legal system, but it's a way that the Library of Congress uses to keep tabs on your book and record your book. And she said that, you know, this, your book leans more fantasy than sci-fi, so we're going to put under fantasy. And yet I'll get readers saying this felt like an Indian version of Star Wars. And I'm like a little confused, because there's no space. There's no space. There's no space travel and whatnot. And so I really believe that, you know, publishers are not the answer when it comes to how to perfectly emulate or convey the idea of science fantasy. I think that goes more so towards the reader community, who always, I think, has a better grasp on what they want to read than publishers do. Publishers are, I think, are always playing catch up. So I think I would more so lean on the reading community, because, you know, every readers are smart individual people who have a great love for storytelling, and they're the ones who can more so perceive like this is quote unquote science fantasy, this is quote unquote hard sci-fi, this is quote unquote more so fantasy or urban fantasy or space fantasy. I think we should let readers have the power to do that versus publishers.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, everyone unmute. I want this to be just like jump in when you have some opinions. We're going to build on what Aparna is saying and kind of try to dissect the big question, which is like why some readers, authors, industry folks consider science fantasy not to be science fiction or consider it to be not fantasy. I just want to open it up to all of you, whoever has some comments on it.
Well, just the fact that we're calling it science fantasy, I mean, like by definition, it is neither science fiction nor is it fantasy. It truly is its own thing. And Porter makes a really good point. Like it's really ultimately the readers who determine, I think, the ultimate legacy of a book and how it's considered. The genre considerations really are for selling purposes. And mm-hmm. I think whether something gets shelved as sci-fi or shelved as whether a science fantasy book gets on the science fiction shelf or on the fantasy shelf, I think a lot has to do with the proportion of fantastical to non-fantastical elements. Mm-hmm. The way Aparna has described some readers responding to her book, it sounds like it has to do with how much the particular thing is in there. And of course, Shannon's point about the gender context today is also very well. I won't say more about that.
Okay. Does anyone else want to jump in?
I feel like that kind of, you know, nails it for the most part. It really is just kind of like a funnel to, you know, try and get it in front of the reader that they think might like it the most. But I'm self-published, so I kind of get to choose that. But I've been wrong. I've been told that my book leans too fantasy and stuff. So I think at the end of the day, just like Aparna said, that the reader is going to decide what it is. And there's only so much we can kind of do on our end to like funnel it that way so that more people that like that kind of thing get it. Mm-hmm. When it comes to like the broad stroke of it, you know, we could have there's only so many categories that like a bookstore will hold. Unless you get like a gigantic, you know, mall sized bookstore, which would be awesome. I would love to go there.
You gotta go to Powell's in Portland.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know this.
Yeah.
This sounds like heaven. That's awesome.
Have you been to Powell's in Portland?
Far too many times. I was just there 2 weeks ago for an event. Ah. Yeah, we keep saying that readers are smart and readers are very smart, but readers are also people. And mm-hmm. sometimes they want exactly what they want. That's part of what genre is for. You know, I read a lot of fan fiction. I love fan fiction. It is a genre into and of itself, and it's always free and in my computer, and that's great. But if I click on a piece of fan fiction that says it is Veronica Mars, Slow Burn, all of those other things, and what I find is a fast-paced Avengers heist movie, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how much I would love a fast-paced Avengers heist. Mm-hmm. It has just pissed me off righteously. I bought a trilogy of YA novels during the lockdown because they were ostensibly about a horrible global pandemic killing everyone. And I love global pandemic books. They are my comfort reads. So I bought this, and then it was not about a global pandemic. It was about giant nanotech from space that fell like snowflakes and melted you if it touched you. And I'm pretty sure they were actually pretty good books. But I hated them. I left one of them out on the porch to get killed by rain because they lied to me. They told me they were going to be one thing and then they were something else.
Yeah.
That's
why very much got a match.
That they then don't deliver on the romance tropes they have promised and readers get mad. That is absolutely accurate. If you are writing in a genre and presenting yourself as in that genre, you need to fulfill the rules of the genre or your readers are going to feel tricked and deceived. So genre is mostly important because it is like labeling whether or not something contains nuts at the grocery store.
Mm. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the promise you make the reader, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a base level promise made there. It's like, I'm not going to let you down. I wrote sci-fi at least.
Yeah.
And then, hopefully they like the rest of the weird stuff you do.
What are some ways that authors can kind of approach that in the terms of like, I know obviously like once you get into TradPub, you lose a bit of control in terms of like what your final book blurb is going to be, for instance, but like ways that you can kind of like pitch your book to readers to give them the most clear idea of what expectations they have going into it, such that, you know, like with you, Sean, reading that book, thinking you're going to get a global pandemic, but actually you're going to get like a gray, what is it, like the gray goose scenario? I think that's like,
yeah, it was a gray goo apocalypse. Scenario. I mean, I'm pretty sure they were good, but I hate them.
Yeah.
Know the genre.
It's because you were deceived. Writing. It's because you were expecting something.
Yeah, I don't like to be lied to. Know the genre in which you are writing and be able to clearly present that to your editor. Listen if they tell you that you are wrong so that you can be prepared with a defense. If they tell you, oh, this is a romance, and you're like, but there's no happy ever after, and I didn't deliver on these six romance tropes that are going to make people mad, you're the one that's going to take it in the teeth from readers if they present it that way, because you're the one that will be lying. I write urban fantasy. I don't write paranormal romance. I've had people review my urban fantasies as if they were paranormal romance. They are really, really bad paranormal romance. I think that there is one on-screen sex scene in 36 books total. That's, if you're here for the spicy, I'm serving white people food. Like, this is not going to make you happy. But I'm honest about that. Social media is your friend in that area. You will never reach everyone. But just be upfront about what you've written and what you're presenting. Hey, I'm your bland white bread author in terms of spiciness, but I've got good diversity and I've got an interesting folkloric approach to the entire globe. So this is what you will get from me, and this is what you won't. You really can't control it all. My publisher likes me, so they tend to listen to me, and they still put a cover on a recent book of mine that I actively asked them not to, because it made a promise to the reader that the book did not fulfill.
Right. Yeah.
So.
It's so tricky, man. Yeah. Because like Alex, like for you, from your transition from self-pub to traditional publishing with the Combat Code series, how was it for you to be able to like have that control of how you were marketing it and then working with a publisher to kind of rebrand it while maintaining what you had sustained before with the series, but also introducing it to new readers with new covers and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, certainly there are a lot of positives and negatives. It's tough going from self-pub, where I actually enjoyed to some extent running a little business that was, you know, the self-published book, my little sphere as far as marketing and you know, hiring cover artists. I like that sort of thing, but it was just really taking too much of my time and not it wasn't my main stream of income, so it became an issue. And so traditional publishing with Orbit, the positives were, of course, you know, getting a good team on board and them taking the reins on all of that. And of course, I had throughout my opinions on various things. And I voiced it, as Sean had said, I think I voiced it pretty well at various times and was also open to, expertise and feedback and tried to rein it in. So it was definitely just a new path on that end. Did I even answer your question, Adrian?
Do you think that this new path has marketed the series in the right way to kind of give readers a sense of like what they can expect?
Largely yes, but then also, you know, it's tough because when you put something, just looking at sci-fi and fantasy, end of the day, it would be fantastic if we could have have both as far as shelving, because especially with traditional publishing, more so than self-publishing, that, you know, bookstore sales are a massive part of it. Most of it, really, as far as how a book will sink or swim. And so it's tough that you only have science fiction or fantasy. And so you're bound to have readers on either end of that are going to be have expectations that are not fulfilled. As Sean was saying, you know, Sean was talking about subgenres and that those get very specific. And so if you mess up on a subgenre and they think it's one subgenre and it's not, then you're really messing up. But as far as science fiction and fantasy, there are much broader strokes that readers expect or don't expect. And I think, but that just comes with the territory, but it would be nice. I understand why there's not a science fantasy shelf, but maybe we should.
They should just shove it right in between science fiction and fantasy. Just have a little middle section.
I'm sure there are. Does Powell's have one? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
So the issue with a science fantasy shelf is it would almost immediately be populated only by books by women and by people with non-English names.
Basically, I understand. Because
science fantasy is very much viewed as lesser by a large proportion of the community, and they would put us on the lower step. And I wish I could sound less cynical. I hate that I sound this cynical, but it is true.
It is true. You're right. Yeah. At the end of the day, it comes down to marketing and to what is going to sell to the appropriate audience, and that's what's going to win. Those are the wins that the publishers will follow.
Mm-hmm. I would love it if we could be a tiny bit more granular, but even there, things get screwed up. There's a bookstore near me that has an urban fantasy section and a paranormal romance section. And guess who is pretty reliably in paranormal romance, where I will do nothing but piss off and upset readers.
Yeah. I want to carry off on that, because there's this new genre that's come about called romantasy, right? And there's a lot of hubbub of like, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. How do you define romantasy? Is it romance with just a little bit of fantasy? Is it fantasy with a romantic subplot? Is it like, I think what that's the interesting part is like these subgenres don't have clear codes and rules. Even with like, we spent a whole panel discussing what is science fantasy, right? There are no, you know, the clear concrete rules might differ from person to person, but romantasy that might differ from person to person. So again, like it's this really tricky game of categorization that I feel like at the end of the day, authors don't really win at, because if you're blending different genres together, how do you put that in a succinct way, like that's pithy and marketing forward, like this is X, Y, and Z, but actually it blends all of those things together and it might be too long to put in a blurb.
Yeah. I mean, Aparna, for your book, it's like, since you do have this, like, what is it, like enemies to lovers kind of element to it with the romance, are there, how many readers do you get, or just in general, like feedback that you've read where people say like, I didn't know there was romance in here, and either they dislike that or they really like that or somewhere in between?
Well, if you go on my social media channels, you will realize that there is an enemies to lovers, because I will.
No, like half of your like TikToks are like, you want to see how spicy shit gets?
Yeah, I was like, but this is okay. I will also, my Indian ancestors will be sad because it's very mild. There's no spice in my book.
Yeah, it is.
So that's just what I feel comfort is like. When people ask me, it's like, is it spicy? I'm like, no, it's not. Like, it's swoony. If you like swoony books,
swoony is a good word for it. Yeah.
Swoony, yeah. But otherwise, no spice. Sorry, you got to go to paranormal romance for that. But it's really funny.
Don't go read Shannon's books.
You know, it's really funny you bring that, because like I'll get varying, like I've heard from like I'll get like DMs, like very beautiful DMs from readers, or I'll get comments where people will say like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, the slow burn aspect was like just correct, like, you know, like I want that, it was like perfect, like they don't kiss until like 500 pages in, like this is what I want. And some people are like, I wish they had gone together sooner. I'm like, you can't you know, that's where I'm saying, like, these subgenres are so specific to person to person and how they define it. Like, even with romanticy, like, someone just commented that it has its own nomination category in Goodreads. Personally, I saw books on there which I wouldn't think would be romanticy. I thought they were more like fantasy with a little bit of a romance element to it. And that's where, like, things kind of get murky and gray. And as Shannon said, you might, you know, start pissing off readers who think, like, oh, I want a romanticy that's spicy, and it's just people, like, you know, like messing around and maybe riding dragons. I don't know, you know.
Does anyone else have any comments on all this genre, this nebula genre shit? Tom?
No, I'll just, you know,
I don't want to get into it.
It's timey-wimey, you know, weird, you know, lots of blending, lots of very specific things. And yeah, like we kind of said, like, at the end of the day, I think the reader is the ultimate judge of where things belong. And we don't know. It's like pitching balls at a batter, right? Like, you don't know if they're going to hit it or if they're going to, you know, totally miss it or just, you know, throw popcorn at you from the stands or something like that. I think it's interesting. I this conversation has been pretty awesome about, you know, like the blend of it and just how, you know, because you think, I felt like when I read the title, like, oh, is sci-fi, you know, truly, or sci-fi fantasy truly sci-fi? I'm like, well, yeah, duh. And then, like, after hearing everything, I'm like, it is, but there's so much to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's very subjective, and you know, it's just interesting to see. I wonder where things will be in like 10 years with reading. Yeah. And everything.
Yeah, because we've been talking so much about readers and the sort of sway that they have in subjectively, individually dictating what they feel this particular thing is. But I feel like fandom is one of the most, it can be like the most invigorating thing, but it can also be the most like toxic thing. And I'm looking specifically at things like, someone in the comments was asking if we'd already touched on the Star Wars, Star Trek kind mm-hmm. of contrast. And we can kind of dig into it a little bit more, but then it's like you have the fandom behind things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I would argue that so much of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is science fantasy, whereas it started out being more based on Earth, more scientific with things like Iron Man. But then it is like you start to introduce Guardians of the Galaxy and you introduce Thanos and the Avengers and all this different kind of stuff. Shit gets really science fantasy, you know? Mm-hmm. And then for, you know, like Con, you're saying, actually, I write space fantasy. And when people look at Star Wars, they might immediately think this is sci-fi from a general pop culture and sort of like, you know, public lens. But once you get into it, it's like, no, actually there's like weird magic and there's kind of like a cult of people who use that magic and then have like light sticks that they fight each other with and are able to manipulate like reality. It's fucking science fantasy. It's space fantasy at that point. So it's like, how do you all feel about the ways in which fandom have kind of pushed this forward with, I think, movies more so than fiction have been debated within fandoms and fandoms that kind of like compete with each other? Because I know Star Wars and Star Trek fandoms are kind of like, you know, there's a lot of teasing that goes on between them and whatnot. So whoever wants to jump in.
I'm just going to add something real quick. You know, it's funny that you brought up Star Wars, because I remember reading this interview with J.J. Abrams where he calls Star Wars a spiritual story. Like, he doesn't say it's not a sci-fi story. It's a spiritual mm-hmm. story. And it's funny because when you start peeling back some of the layers, the idea of the Force, the Jedi, you see there's people who like bring up how there's like associations with Buddhism and Hinduism. There's a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of the Force is very similar to the idea of Brahman, Brahma, and like how this ultimate reality of the universe. So I feel like it's really interesting going, just reiterating your point, where like something that the artist, the creator who, you know, might have this idea, but once it goes out, you know, to the general public, the perception, maybe it's like, oh no, this is about like, you know, swords, like light sticks and like, you know, sci-fi or sci-fi fantasy. It's not a spiritual story at all. Some people might call it a love story. I've seen TikToks where those people will say Star Wars is actually a love story for me. And I think it's just really interesting how people categorize it.
Yeah. Or even like Dune, because Dune's gotten like the big resurgence because of the new movies, but it's like
Dune all the perfume ads, all the perfume ads, all the shots that look like perfume ads.
Yeah. It's like, do you want to smell like a rat? Yeah, do you want to smell like a sandworm?
Do you want to smell?
Oh, you smell like cinnamon, which is the spice.
Oh, dude, I want
a little bit better than a worm.
The whole world, cinnamon, really? I can't.
No, but Zendaya and Timothy Chalamet are like the perfect perfume cologne kind of combo. It's great.
Yeah.
Do you want to smell like a Fremen?
If they don't,
come on, let's get it going.
If they don't capitalize on pumpkin spice season, then they're really missing the
Does anyone else want to jump in on this kind of notion of fandom and how that has kind of driven these discussions and kind of pushed? I think pushed a lot of these franchises beyond like the normal bounds of popularity.
Oh, no, you go ahead. You go ahead.
I was just going
to
say
that. We'll go back to Tom after.
I love readers and readership, but fandom scares me a little bit. and there is there's definitely a personal psychology element to it. Because fans, people that consider themselves fans, the thing that they are a fan of becomes a part of their personal identity. And I think that that's where a lot of the resistance to new ideas, to a main character being a girl, comes from, because they're like, well, I'm not a girl, so I can't. How dare they like make this thing that I love like center a female protagonist when I'm not a girl and that I'm not, you know, like. And all that kind of stuff comes up, I think, in a very unconscious, unprocessed way. And that freaks me out, honestly. And that's kind of why I stay out of fan spaces, even of things that I am a fan of. So that's all I have to say about that.
I agree that fandom is often a bit terrifying.
Sean, that is part of why we need diverse books and stories. It's not just that seeing yourself in fiction is a very powerful thing. It's that seeing other people in fiction teaches us, especially when we're children, on a primal level, that those people are humans too. And it sounds ridiculous that that needs to be learned, but everything needs to be learned. Short of breathing and having a heartbeat, you learn everything. No one ever told me that I couldn't identify with a little white boy because I wasn't one. And yet we hear all the time, I couldn't identify with that character because their skin was a different color. I couldn't identify with that color, with that character because their genitals were different. I couldn't identify with that character because they loved a gender that I don't love. So we really just need to keep broadening the diversity in stories in order to make that stop. And it's never going to completely stop. There will always be people who prefer to read about characters that look like them. And that's a good thing. You know, I have a friend who is from a combination of marginalized groups. And at this point, she will not read any books where the main character doesn't share at least two aspects of her identity. Because she spent her entire life being told that little white boys were relatable and she was not. And that's not just fandom that's reinforcing it. It's everyone. It's all of us all the time until we intentionally unlearn those prejudices. Which is super fun. but as Whimsy Dearest says, some shippers can get kind of intense. You know, Charlene Harris, who wrote the Sookie Stackhouse books, is a friend of mine. And I was with her on her last book tour, and she was receiving actual death threats. Because her main character wound up with the wrong man at the end. She had two potential love interests. One of them could get her pregnant. One could not. The character had always had Haven raise her own children as a major life goal. From book one, she was talking about how much she wanted to be pregnant and be a mom and have kids of her own. That was not a surprise. It was not a new character attribute. Mm-hmm. But people still threaten Charlaine, who is just, she is a hobbit. She is the quintessential hobbit grandmother. She is the nicest woman in the world. And they were like, I'm going to stab you, little old lady, because Sookie didn't get with the guy that can't knock her up. Some shippers kind of scare me.
Yeah. Fandom.
Don't threaten Charlaine.
Don't threaten anybody just because they write a story. In general, don't threaten anybody.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the police won't convict me if I hit you with a chair for threatening Charlaine.
Seanan will throw paranormal romance books at you. Just
those things can be heavy. And they're you get the hardcovers.
Yeah.
Like grab a good Anne Bishop book. You could concuss somebody with that.
Yeah. She's going to come at you with a fucking hardcover.
I am.
Yeah, special fandom, edition. Fandom is a strange place, though. It's like, I think especially with Star Wars and Star Trek, you know, my oldest brother is huge into Star Trek. But like growing up, I actually kind of pushed against that, maybe because he was trying to push it on me too hard. Whereas like I was attracted more to Star Wars. And, you know, I grew up with the prequel series. And that was kind of like my first introduction to fandom of like, how dare you introduce midichlorians and Anakin's a little turd and all this shit is like so much hate spreading around everything. Or like, oh, like Padme and Anakin's romance is so horrible. And it's like, I didn't give a shit because I was like 13 or whatever. But I think, you know, at this point, like, we can all agree that yes, science fantasy is sci-fi. Yes, science fantasy is also fantasy. Genre distinctions are kind of ridiculous, and readers should just love the things that they love, but don't piss in someone else's cereal. Don't threaten them. Don't threaten beautiful little hobbit ladies with you know, expectations of what the romance should have been, because this shit is not in your control. And at the end of the day, if you love the story, you love the story. And if you don't, you don't. Don't tag Aparna in fucking one-star reviews. Don't tag any author in one-star reviews, because that's just mean. And I think now we're going to open it up to a Q&A section just here at the end to wrap it up a little bit. If anyone in the comments has any questions that they want to ask, shoot them into the live chat right now. I think I've got a couple starred here, so I'm just going to pull one up. This is from Beth Tabler. How are you, Beth, my dear? This is actually in response to something that Seanan brought up earlier. So I'll just toss it up there. Do you think that authors who maintain a name that is androgynous are assumed to be male when it comes to sci-fi? I think we can kind of like broaden that to sci-fi, science fantasy, speculative fiction in general, if anyone wants to tackle that.
Yes, to a degree. I was assumed male at first, which was super fun when I showed up at some conventions that had put me on panel track to provide a male perspective. Because Seanan is not a common name outside of rural Ireland. Hey, Shannon is much more common, but that is not my name. And even that is gender neutral enough that you do tend to get that assumption. They'll first look at the name, is it initials? Is it a male or androgynous name? Names have no gender, but assumptions will be made. Then they tend to look at the contents of the book. Is it a romance? Does it have a scantily clad woman on the cover? Lots of different things. But on the whole, you will find that those books are assumed to be written by male authors. Rob Thurman experienced that. Basically, any of the initial people experience that. J.S. Fields experiences that. And it can be a sales boost long enough to get people invested in the series before you go, hey, guess what? That's the part.
You want to come to my signing? Aparna?
I would just wanted to add that it was something, it's actually a question that came up for me when it picking like my pen name, if I wanted to go with my real name, or do I want, because in fantasy, sci-fi, science fantasy, if it's a woman's name, sometimes people don't pick up the book because, as Shannon just said, they have like these prejudice, they have these like notions of like what this book will be. Oh, it might be YA because it's a female assuming writer who's writing it, so it has to be YA. It could never be adult, you know? I don't have a middle name. My friends call me No Middle Name Verma. And I was like, I have to make up a fake initial. And I thought it was like AA Verma. They're like, it's too lame. Just go with your name. It rhymes. And so I was like, okay, I'll end up going with my name. And it was a source of pride because, you know, it's a name that my parents gave me. It's a name that shows, you know, that I've, you know, just shows who I am. And so it was a point of contention of like, do you change your name to show that you're not, you know, so people don't judge just off your name of who you are and then make presumptions about it.
Yeah. Tom, why did you decide to go with T.A. Bruno? I've always wondered this.
Oh, funny story about that. So the only reason I went with T.A. Bruno was because there was another Tom Bruno that was writing self-published books, and I didn't want to step on his toes, honestly. But it goes a little deeper than that because I work in the film industry and I do previs, and there is another Tom Bruno that does previs in the film industry. And this became an issue when my poor elderly grandfather was watching movies and he's like, oh, I saw that movie you worked on. And it's like, I didn't work on that one. And it was even worse because, like, for instance, one example was, so I worked on Captain America Winter Soldier, but I did not work on Captain America, the first one. And my grandpa went and watched the first one. He's like, oh, and I rooted. I was cheering when I saw your name. And I'm like, oh, grandpa. Anyway, so yeah, that was first. And then as I went into making my own books, I'm like, I just quickly Google. I'm like, oh, there is another Tom Bruno. I'm like, I'm not doing that again. So I just went with T.A. Bruno. It stands for Thomas Andrew Bruno. That's it. So totally, yeah, a little bit funnier of a story than just, I looked at, you know.
So. Your poor grandpa. He's so proud of you.
Yeah, it got to a point where I just started going like, yeah, I had a great time on it.
You don't want to take away from the experience that he had watching that movie.
Exactly. Like, he was having a great time. Well, it's even funnier because like previs, like nobody knows what it is. So they're like, oh, yeah, you animated the movies. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Fine. Like, do you want the long explanation or do you just want to like enjoy that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
nice, man. Okay, Jim McCleary is asking, what's the best place to find fantasy alpha and beta readers? We can just open that up to alpha and beta readers in general. I don't know how all of you approach that in your work.
I'm self-published, so it might be very different. Well, and it sounds like a lot of you guys self-published for a while too. But what I typically do is I do have like a select little group of people that I've just come to know and trust with some of it that I'll kind of get a pass in front of. But other than that, there's also a couple services you can kind of hire, like Literary Titans, one I go to every now and then, that, you know, they offer a beta reading service. Or I think you could even go on something like Fiverr or anything now. I haven't tried that myself. But it's good. You know, you get what you get out of it. It's one of those, you have to be the final judge on whether it's useful or whether, you know, you can bounce with that information. And I also have a very important thing I call the mom pass, where I have my mom read it. And if, you know, because again, we're writing sci-fi fantasy, she's not much of a sci-fi reader, but if I can deliver her information that isn't confusing and it's like in a way that's digestible, then I know I've got something going on there. But that's just my personal process there. I'm sure there's maybe even way more effective ways than doing it, but that's just the way I've found it works for me.
I like the mom pass. That's nice.
Yeah, it's my most important pass, in my opinion. It's like, mom gets it, then I know I got something here.
Yeah.
See, that's funny because I feel like if I gave, like, my, there's no spice, but my mom is very conservative, so I feel like if I gave it to her, she would have a chapel ready to throw at me. And I was like, listen, I can't be in the same room when you read these books.
They brushed fingers of Parna. God.
I know. She just like they kissed. Oh my God. Oh, there. She's very, very traditional. And like if there's a kiss in even in a Bollywood movie, she's like, does a look at it. It's quite funny. For me, it's the same thing with Tom. I go with really close, trusted friends that I've developed through, you know, through the English department at Stanford, or through people who really connected with my books, like especially the first book. So what's great about being self-published first, I think, was that I was able to have I could really figure out who like the super fans were like really, really early on. And because of that, I've been able to cultivate very strong relationships, and there are some who I would, you know, send it to like, you know, be a beta reader, like, you know, once it's more of like in a better shape of like, hey, you know, you get an early, you know, thanks for being with me ever since like really day one. I would love to hear, you know, your feedback. And it's a way of like, you know, I always feel as a paying it back to the people who supported you since day one. And I think it's a fun treat for them. It's like, oh my gosh, you get to see the book and give advice in like the editing stage. And I, you know, if one of my favorite authors allowed me to do that, I would be like crying or like on my knees, like, thank you. This is amazing. I think it's also really, you know, you have someone who really loves the stories and the characters as much as you do, and which is really hard to find. And so you can almost, for me, I value that opinion because they see the book in a similar light as I do. And I know, you know, their opinions will have justice, you know, will do justice to the characters and the stories. That being said, I keep it to like maybe five or so people. I don't like having too many cooks in the kitchen. It gets too overwhelming.
Yeah, five's right a pretty on. Good number. That's like a nice, not too many.
Sean and Colin, Alex, do you have any comments?
So at this point, I still have my group of beta readers from when I was in the fanfic mines. And whenever I look at acquiring someone new, I remember what happened to Stephanie Meyer and freak out a little bit. You know, she's the Twilight Lady. I don't normally say, oh, poor Stephanie and her mountains of money. Oh, my God. but the last book she was writing for that series, one of her beta readers leaked the whole fucking thing online. Oh God, I hope we didn't have a rule against swearing. I've done really well.
Have you not heard me swear like many
times? Yeah,
I have the filthiest mouth. So good. They put the whole fucking thing online because they thought that it would help her with her insecurities.
Mm-mm. Oh,
I would die. Of course.
You would literally find my corpse
lying on the floor, half eaten by the cats. And unfortunately, and Aparna, you're going to get to discover this soon, I hope, once you hit a certain level of readership, you can't trust everyone anymore, even if you really, truly want to, because there will be people who think that for clout, they can leak stuff. I write for Magic the Gathering, the card game, and my NDA is thicker than some novellas. Because they have to be able to tightly control everything I'm allowed to say. There are 100% people that will take any crumb of privileged information they feel like they have and just run to the hills so that they can be the one that gets the scoop. And they will do that with your fiction, and that's horrible. Stick with people you really and truly trust, that you know well, and that you have the home addresses for in case you need to take them out with a folding chair.
No,
or
we already determined. We already determined.
Yeah,
like
hardcover.
Or a hardcover. It is legal in the United States to mail turtles, live turtles. And I think that if you just receive one box of pissed off snapping turtle, you'll never do anything like that again.
That's really funny.
That is so good. Con, Alex, do you have any final comments?
Yeah, I just have one. I have one very trusted friend that we trade works back and forth, and we both don't care about one another's opinions and very much care about one another's opinions in a good way. So it works out. And then, you know, once on the trad end, of course, I saw a recent conversation on one of the social media networks about how rough of a draft people send to their agents, or I guess it was agents or editors, I guess on that end, like a lot of people's agents might serve as a beta reader. And it's different if you're a querying author. That's going to be a completely different experience, if, you know, whether or not you have alpha or beta readers prior to querying, versus if you are already have agented, then you might send some pretty rough stuff to your agent depending on your relationship with them.
Yeah. And there are some agents out there who do not want to do edits or correct. Sort of like beta passes, but then there are some who are really keen to be involved in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will just add quickly, it's really important to find your community. I was very lucky to get folded into a couple of Discord communities of writers, and they were early readers. Some of them were early readers on Circus Infinite, and subsequent books I've written. And for Circus, you know, not that I'm anybody now, but before Circus was published, I really was. And I have several friends that are really, really voracious readers. And I liked the way that they talk about the books that they like and the way that they kind of really dig into books that they don't like and why they don't like them. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I could trust. So I knew that they were well read enough, widely read enough, and did not mince words as far as their opinions. And so that's who I went to for my first beta readers. But now mm-hmm. tends to be other writers I know and also my agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important. Find your community. Find the genres that you love. Fuck what anybody else says about them. I think we can all agree at this point that we've gathered that genre distinctions are kind of bullshit. Science fantasy can be whatever you as an individual want it to be, whether you're a writer, whether you're a reader. You just got to find the right people to read it, and hopefully they won't bombard you with one-star reviews or anything like that. And hopefully they'll give you smiles and high fives and all that instead. And
not Michelle View.
Yeah, exactly. And we're not going to mail fucking turtles to you. We're
not gonna, like, why not?
It's stuck on the table, though.
If they give us smiles and hugs, I'm not going to mail snapping turtles to you.
I will mail them turtles, a snapping like, turtle, but I could yeah. send them a nice slider.
That's yeah. true. Yeah. Okay. If you like Shauna's book, she'll mail you a nice turtle. But if you do something bad to her, she'll mail you a snapping turtle. I think that's what we can all agree on. All right. Well, closing out, I just like all of you to let folks know where they can find you on social media if you want to promote your work a little bit. Shauna, we'll start with you.
So you can basically find me just about anywhere if you can spell my name. I am on Twitter, Blue Sky, Tumblr more than anywhere else right now. My website is shaunanmcguire.com, and you can find me on TikTok lurking and liking people's POV videos, but not ever posting anything. Really, Tumblr is probably the best place to actually be sure you have located me. Right now, Twitter is just whining about the fact that I had a pipe burst in my garage last week. And I do have, this is a light year for me. I'm so happy. I only have 4 books coming out. So I have a book coming out in March that is Aftermarket Afterlife, and that is the 13th book in the Encrypted series. And don't read it if you haven't read the first one. You'll be very confused. My publicist would like me to stop saying things like that, but it's true. Discount Armageddon is the start of the series. That is where the Fergonomics really come into play, and it's probably the most science fantasy thing I've done. So pick it up. Have a good time. Also, I just had a pipe burst, so book sales are good.
There's something for everybody. Awesome. Thank you, Shonen. And Khan?
My website is khanwong.com, and I am on Blue Sky and Threads and Facebook and Instagram. Just find my name or maybe add author. I'm Khan Wong author on a couple of those, but if you look up my name, there I will be. The Circus Infinite is out now, and it's available wherever books are sold. My next book is called Down in the Sea of Angels. It is not due out for another year. So, and we're entering into the editing and cover design and all that good stuff. So I'm going to be laying low for a little bit about it, but I'll just forewarn you now, in about 9 months.
Awesome. Thank you, Con. Alex?
Yeah, so I'm Combat Codes is actually my handle on all these social media things. I'm the only one I'm not on is Blue Sky. I'm on the other ones, not really Twitter quite as much. I haven't abandoned it fully, but I'm there here and there. But I get, like Sean had said, I'm not really posting as much and kind of just retweeting publisher stuff and that sort of thing. But I am on Instagram, Threads, a little bit. I started doing that a bit, but so Combat Codes is the handle on all of that.
Yeah, and go pick up Combat Codes and yes. Griever's Blood. And Tom?
I'm Tom, or T.A. Bruno, as to not get mixed up with the other Tom Brunos in the world. I wrote Song of Kamaria trilogy and the Down Below Beyond that just came out. Currently, I'm just kind of outlining something and seeing kind of where it goes. It's been pretty fun so far, drawing a lot of pictures. You can find me on pretty much all of them, all those social medias at T.A. Bruno Author. The two I use the most seem to be Instagram, and I'm still on the Twitter X thing they call it now. I post a lot of stuff about just reading and writing, and I also do a lot of art, so I post some of that stuff too. And do it.
Awesome. Do it, man. Aparna?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, due to my job, I'm sadly chronically online, so you will find me all the time on social media. I'm most active on TikTok, which is Aparna Writes. I'm not really on Twitter X anymore, but I am very active on Instagram. It's the same handle, spirited_gal. There's also my website, theapurnaverma.com. The Phoenix King is available anywhere. The second book, which I don't think I can reveal the title yet, is currently undergoing edits, and I'm really excited. We're hoping, so like the first book has artwork inside, and we're hoping, yeah. I'm trying to get my publisher to get the second book to have colored artwork, so please. Fingers crossed it happens. We'll see. Orbit, are you listening? If you're listening, I'm watching you.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you all so much for hanging out with me, talking science fantasy. I really appreciate it, just sharing all your knowledge, having some fun, spending some time with us here at TBR Con 2024. You can find me pretty much everywhere at Adrian M. Gibson, or you can check out my podcast, SFF Addicts Pod. We got new episodes out every Tuesday. Con's been on in the past on a panel, Tom as well. Done interviews with Alex and Aparna. Sean, we got to get you on the podcast as well. Yeah, hope you all check it out. And I just really appreciate you spending the time here with us today. And thank you very much.